From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For the musician David Lowery, this question about how we pay for music or information in the internet era is a moral one. It's a matter of ethics. It's an issue for journalists and musicians because of what Lowery calls a free culture that has emerged. These are people who expect music and news to be not only instantly accessible, but free. You can get a news story for free on an aggregator site or bust through a paywall. You can get a song from a file sharing site, but then who pays the musician? Who pays the reporter? At some point, something's got to give, right? Or are new business models and new ecosystems adapting to all this change, and are people just overreacting? Those are the questions we're talking about today, and we hope you'll join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. About a year ago, this debate played out online about the music industry in the era of the internet, where you have all these file sharing sites and streaming, and it's not really all that hard to avoid actually paying for the music you listen to. The debate began with a piece written by an intern for the NPR music site All Songs Considered, and in it she explained what an avid music listener she was, how important music had been in her life. But then she confessed that while she may have bought plenty of concert tickets, plenty of merchandise, she and most of her friends have never, she said, supported physical music as consumers. It prompted a sharp response from David Lowery, the musician who started the band Camper Van Beethoven. He's been pretty vocal about this issue. And Lowery says the digital age has created immoral and unethical business models. And he says people are being asked to change their principles to adapt. We'll get to Lowery here in a moment. But today in the program, we're talking about paying your way in the digital age. And we're extending the conversation beyond just music to the financial crisis going on in journalism, for example, and in television, too. There are a lot of ideas out there for how you finance web content. There's crowdfunding and paywalls and pay-per-play. But are these really realistic and sustainable? And what happens to quality journalism and entertainment if we can't figure this out? We invite you to join us. How are you thinking about all of this? And here's a question. Do you pay for the music you listen to or the news articles that you read? Why or why not? You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Earlier today, we spoke with David Lowery. He's the founder of Camper Van Beethoven. He's co-founder of the band Cracker. His blog, Tricordist, focuses on artist issues and the internet. He's also a lecturer at the University of Georgia on business there. And he joined us earlier by phone. Lowery says that a free culture has emerged in the era of the internet. And I asked him to explain what he means.
Well, there really is a movement. It's a free culture movement. On one extreme, it's the pirate party. At the other end is sort of gussied up in sort of pseudo-intellectual language. You sort of have like people like Lawrence Lessig from Creative Commons and Harvard University. Let's put it this way, it's a misguided effort to weaken copyright with the notion that somehow this is going to make society better, and actually all it'll really do is just completely defund anybody who's making music, books, films, illustrations, photographs, etc., etc. I find the pirate party to be much more refreshing to talk to than the academics, because at least they're honest about what they're doing. I'm serious.
You've been teaching about the economics of the music business at the University of Georgia for a number of years now. So I wonder, is this a generational thing? And what are you learning about their attitudes and their behavior?
Some people want to, cast this as a generational thing, but I think that's a poor description. And here's why. It's largely divided along the lines of people who have nothing better than to do than to sort of sit on the internet and sort of download movies and sit on Facebook and go to forums and stuff like that. And then people who kind of are kind of in the real world and sort of utilize the internet in a more practical way. And this is why I say this. When I wrote that letter to the NPR intern, that went beyond the blog and the Facebook and the Twitter world, it actually went out into like a much broader range of society. One of our neighbors was walking home from church. Is like, we just discussed your letter at church today. Once you get off of the internet with people who basically have a lot of time on their hands to sit on the internet and moan and bitch, you get to people who tend to share my view that artists need to be compensated, that this file sharing activity is actually a form of freeloading, and it's really kind of a pro-corporate, anti-little guy, anti-freak, weirdo musician activity. And I don't find it's generational at all.
You mentioned that the question is, you know, who's funding this free culture movement? Because it seems like you're saying this isn't some organic thing. It's actually financed by these large tech corporations.
Absolutely. I mean, and it comes in like sort of semi-subtle ways, like whereby you see an ad for, say, Charter Cable, and it's bragging about how fast their internet service is, right? And it's telling you how long it takes you to download a movie and to download a song, right? And the little graphic that they're showing is not what you get when you're downloading a movie, say, from iTunes. You're getting a graphic that looks very much like a BitTorrent file graphic. Let's face it, this is well documented. A large portion of broadband traffic is illicit file sharing. And so there's a reason that people pay for that extra high-speed connection is because you can download stuff faster. And it turns out that 40% of this downloading traffic is files that are not being legally distributed.
We also mentioned you've got companies that buy banner ads on these sites. You've got venture capitalists raising money for them, hardware makers making gear and equipment for them.
Yeah. Kim.com, the famous pirate hero. You know, his service, when you went on there to watch a movie, for instance, you might get it free for like 30 minutes, then it would cut off and demand that you pay for it. But none of the money is going to the artists, those who created it. So essentially, what you've done is you replace sort of the bad old record company system whereby artists didn't get like a great share of royalties with an even worse system whereby artists get no money and the intermediaries keep all the money, right? Then there's also the problem of the ads themselves, right? Okay, so many, many websites are completely ad-supported, right? And here are some of the tiny little small mom-and-pop companies that run the online advertising ecosystem. AOL, Google, Microsoft, Yahoo, right? So these I'm being sarcastic.
Of course.
These are giant companies that are slathering these websites with ads and profiting from doing this. The other thing is that So essentially what you do is you have this system whereby people are willing to pay for the hardware to listen to music, like, you know, my PowerBook or your Galaxy, and you're willing to pay $39, $69 a month or whatever for a broadband connection, but you're not willing to pay the artists. So in this process, this sort of free culture movement, it's completely corporatist. The hardware is all these giant mega corporations. The bandwidth providers are all these mega giant corporations, right? And aside from, say, maybe 800 albums a year, the other 74,000 albums released a year are little small indie or artist-owned or self-released albums, right?
Yeah.
It's quite startling just how, I don't know, to me, you know, regressive of an activity this is.
What really seems to baffle you, too, is this argument that paying for music is not convenient. That seems to really bother you as an idea, like it's really inconvenient to pay for the music that you're buying, that you want to listen to.
Yeah, well, it's not. I mean, first of all, now my crew was kind of hungover the day I did this test, so I might have been a little faster than them or whatever, but we actually had a contest between the crew guys and me to see who could download a song the fastest, either from a pirate site or from, you know, like some legitimate site like Amazon and iTunes. And I won every time, whether it was my computer, my iPad, or my iPhone, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because there's always some sort of stupid pop-up that had to be navigated around. The song, you know, you had to log in or register for one of these cyber locker services or something like that. Or, for instance, in the case of, you know, BitTorrent, if you weren't really kind of in the right swarm, a lot of times they actually couldn't find the song that we were looking for, right? So every time I won, right? So A, it's slower to use these services. And B, often, like I said, oftentimes these services charge you for access to these files. So people were paying anyway. So it's completely a false claim that's not backed up by any credible evidence.
There seems to be a kind of a cruel irony here for you, too, because you point out in that letter that people who seem resistant to paying for music or information is willing, you point out, for example, to pay a little more for, you know, fair trade coffee or to pay more to buy clothing that doesn't come from a sweatshop. That seems like an interesting kind of twist, an irony anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it's really surprising that you have, you know, everyone kind of younger than 35, I would say, maybe not everyone, but a lot of people younger than 35, okay, have really gone out of their way to sort of pay for, you know, sustainable seafood or, say, to eat at the hamburger joint that pays employees, you know, a fair wage and gives them health insurance and stuff like that, right?
Right.
But when it comes to musicians, it's sort of like, hey, screw you, man. You know, you're on your own, right? And it just really doesn't make any sense, except if you consider this, is that usually when you hear people say that, what the problem is that they're under the impression that somehow they're ripping off Hollywood, you know, or they're ripping off the record labels. And just the simple fact is that, you know, well, when you buy a record from a record label, the artist does get a royalty. It may not be that much, but it's way better than Kim.com's royalty, which is zero, okay? And most of the time, like I said, like the 75,000 albums or whatever released in 2011, right? Maybe 800 of those were released by Hollywood, right? The rest of them weren't. They're, you know, they're small independent labels or directly released by the artist, especially in this day and age when, you know, with the process that we call disintermediation, you know, is so strong, you know, most artists are kind of making their own albums and then distributing them directly themselves or through distributors and stuff like that. So when you are just taking this music, you're taking the money directly from the artist's pocket 90% of the time.
You hear this idea that it's somehow the government's responsibility or the responsibility of these large corporations to see to it that this is convenient. And you've written that, in fact, it's an individual's responsibility to behave ethically. I'm not sure if you like the word moral, but do you think this in some way is a...
I have no problem with the word moral.
Yeah.
Okay.
You think it's a moral issue?
I think one of the great strategic arguments that, like, if I can refer to the other side, sort of generically and en masse, like the other side made a really great messaging decision that anytime anybody said anything about morality and ethics, they would say, well, you know, technology has changed the world. And so what was normative behavior before is not not normative behavior now. So you use words like normative and stuff like that, and you go, oh, okay, science. Yeah, okay. But here's the deal. Look, principles are things that don't change. Principles are the things that guide us through times of change. Principles are things that guide us through, like, social upheaval, revolutions, and yes, even technological revolutions. So you do not change your principles to match the technology. But this is the very carefully constructed argument that the free culture movement has created. It's like, well, technology has changed what is, you know, normative behavior. So we're just going to go ahead and rip off artists and indie filmmakers and musicians and photographers and stuff like that because we can. In what world is that an ethical or moral argument? In what world do you want to hang out with people who believe that crap?
That's David Lowery. He blogs at Tricordist. He's founder of the band Camper Van Beethoven. Joined us earlier today by phone from California. We hope you'll join the conversation. Questions, comments, 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're trying to figure out what the costs are, the real costs for all this free media in the internet age. It's not really free. The articles you read on an aggregator site or the music you stream or get from file sharing, someone has to pay the journalist or the musician, right? Well, some say we've become part of a free culture where we just expect this stuff to be not only accessible but free. But how long can you sustain something like this? What does it mean for art or for journalism? And how about you? What are you willing to pay for? You can join us at 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us on the program is Mike Masnick. He is founder of the blog Tech Dirt, which focuses on technology and business analysis, and of the company Floor 64. Last year, he published a report called The Sky is Rising, which makes the case that the entertainment industry is, in fact, enjoying significant growth. And Mike Masnick, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Bob Garfield is also with us today. He's, of course, media critic, co-host of NPR's On the Media, also a columnist for Media Post and The Guardian, and author of, among other books, The Chaos Scenario, which predicted that mass media and advertising would become disconnected. He's joining us today from his studio in Washington, D.C. And Bob, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Doug. Good to be here.
Mike Masnick, I want to start with you because I want to have you respond to some of the things that David Lowery is talking about. What's happening to the music industry? I mean, you often hear that sentiment that things like Spotify and Pandora and all those things are kind of killing the business. But you make a case that the musicians are making, I think you sort of put it this way, more music today for their living than ever before. Is that what you're saying?
Well, yeah, the industry has certainly changed quite a bit, and I think that everyone can agree that it's been very disruptive in a lot of different ways. But there are, without doubt, many more musicians today making music than ever before. It appears that within the last decade or so, probably more music has been created and released than in all of recorded and released in all of human history before that. There are more musicians today making some money from their music than ever before in history. That doesn't mean that they're all making a full living out of it, but they're able to make some money out of it. And there are just more and more ways for people to be able to make music, to release it, to make some money from it, to build a fan base, and to do all sorts of wonderful things. What I think gets left out of the conversation when you look back at the way it was that if you wanted to be a professional musician, if you wanted to make money from music, you know, a decade ago or more, you basically had one path, which was hope that a major record label or maybe a large indie would sign you and give you a lot of money and turn you into a professional musician, and everybody else went home. The difference today is that all those people who used to have to go home can now actually take a different path and create music, release music, build a fan base, and even make some money out of it.
So you've said that in some ways this is kind of a new ecosystem, and is that the way we should be looking at it? Like it's this new system that, and people have to learn to adapt to this new system.
Yeah, I mean, the world has certainly changed. I mean, I don't think anyone can deny the fact that the way that people consume music and the way that musicians and fans connect with each other has changed. And so the ecosystem is very, very different. And I think that, you know, among the many challenges that does create is that there's certainly a lot more competition as well. And there's also less of a clear roadmap. I think one of the challenges that many musicians from past eras certainly face is that they had that roadmap before, which was get signed and then let somebody else take care of everything. And these days, there isn't a clear roadmap. There are lots of different options. There are lots of different paths, and there's no one true path anymore. Each artist has to sort of figure out what makes the most sense for them.
But what do you make of his idea that there's a free culture that has emerged and people feel entitled to music? They want it to be accessible right away, but they also want... they want it free. That's part of the kind of ethic of this free culture. How do you see the culture that's emerged?
Well, I think that there's a combination of factors. There is an element that people would like stuff for free. I think that's, you know, not a surprise or controversial. If given options, when there's a free option, people are certainly interested in it. But if you look more closely, what you see is that people are much more interested in what else that enables. You know, the ability to get a much wider selection of music, not to be forced into the same old top 40 listings as before, the ability to connect with other people over music. I mean, the things that make culture and music such a powerful force is the fact that you're sharing the experience with someone else, that you're having this, you know, a joint experience between multiple people that are all listening to the same thing and enjoying it. Or, you know, how many times do you hear a song because a friend says you have to listen to this? All these kinds of things fit in with that, you know, and that just because you can listen to some music for free and get some music for free doesn't preclude all sorts of new and interesting business models for artists that embrace them and adapt them. And what we've seen is that when artists really learn to embrace these things and build up a strong connection with their community, when they give them options to support them monetarily, it appears to work.
There's a David Lowery mentions, I mean, he sees the music business kind of collapsing. I mean, in this letter that he wrote, he gives these statistics that talks about how recorded music revenue is down. Now, revenue, right? He's talking about revenue, not the number of musicians who are making music or not the, you know, all of these new songs that are being created. But he's talking, I mean, obviously he's a musician, so he's interested in the money that's being made. Recorded music revenue, he says, is down 64% since 1994. Per capita spending, he says, on music is almost 50% lower than it was 35 years ago. And he says, now he sort of, I guess his contention is that there are fewer professional musicians now. I mean, I know you've seen these kinds of numbers. How are you reacting
sure.
to them?
There are different. He's choosing his words very carefully, is what I'll say. When you talk about recorded music sales, they're down. Everyone agrees that they're down. But that's not the only way that musicians make money. And in fact, most musicians make the majority of their money from other sources. When you look at how much revenue is actually going into the music industry, you know, over the last decade, it has actually gone up. If you look at how much money people are actually spending on music, if you look at government statistics on that, it's continued to go up. People are willing to spend more. It is less on recorded music, but recorded music is only a portion of that. There is certainly, you know, the live part of the music industry has continued to grow massively, actually, over the last 15 years or so. There are other areas, new business models, things like Kickstarter and crowdfunding, you know, new sources of being able to make money from services like YouTube and Spotify. And I understand that you know, there are complaints about how much money is made from all of those different things. But when you add it up, what you begin to see is that the amount of opportunity out there has actually grown quite a bit. In terms of the number of musicians, I'm not sure. There have been some debate over that, but if you actually look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics numbers on that, what you see is that it's actually the number of musicians that are employed by the recording industry has gone down. But the actual number of musicians, when you include independent musicians, has actually gone up a significant amount.
Bob Garfield, let me bring you into this conversation because I kind of want to get this beyond just music. I'm wondering, can we apply any of the concerns of David Lowery more broadly, like to journalism and entertainment, those kinds of things?
Absolutely. The music industry is simply a microcosm of what is taking place in the industries that are the channels for all of our media, whether it's Hollywood movies or broadcast TV or cable TV or radio or public radio or magazines and newspapers. All of these forces were unleashed by the same sets of zeros and ones. It's a function of digital revolution, full stop. And what the digital age did was take the power from the oligarchs who were in these businesses because of these vast barriers of entry, enormous amounts of capital, and monopolies on distribution and production, and gave it to everyone. And the consequence of that is there is a huge glut of supply. There are many more songs recorded now than ever before. There is much more written, much more text written than has ever been publicly distributed before in the history of humanity. There's more video created than ever before in the whole history of humanity by many, many orders of magnitude. That's a glut of supply. And as a consequence, that affects the demand side. It means there's not enough money to go around for everybody. It's as simple as that. You can no longer build an industry, a business, any sort of ongoing sustainable commerce in a world in which the supply is so great. And, you know, the business of music piracy and the so-called free culture, which is really just the stealing culture, taking something that belongs to somebody else and using it for yourself without paying for it. I guess that's free. It's also theft. That's just one of the offshoots and not necessarily the most disruptive. What is disruptive is that whether you're a journalist who cannot earn a livelihood, someone getting out of journalism school today cannot begin to expect to have the same middle-class lifestyle that I've enjoyed since 1977. A musician, you know, certainly has access to an audience through free distribution online, but there's no chance of, there's, you know, infinitesimal chance of actually sustaining a livelihood doing that. And it's the true across the board of all media. We are in a revolution, and there's blood in the streets.
Mm. Mike Masnick, do you see it as a revolution? Do you see it in the same kind of way?
I see it as very disruptive, but I have to take issue with some of Bob's comments, which are, you know, historically it's always been incredibly difficult to almost impossible if you wanted to make your living as a musician or even in the media as a reporter. It's always been a very difficult business to get into in the first place. So many, many people just went home and had to find something else to do. And so, you know, if you look at it in that context and you count in all of those people, suddenly those people have the ability to do something, whether it's create a blog or create music or, you know, publish on their own and build up a reputation that way. So I don't, you know, this idea that
I'm not quibbling with your point there, Mike. I'm not saying that it's better now. It was better before that we had a more earning capacity for professional reporters. I'm just simply reporting as a fact that there are no longer business models attached to these very worthwhile pursuits.
Well,
and
I think,
yes, all of the people who didn't have access to a newspaper job in, let's say, 1979, who can blog or what have you today, you know, good for them. And some of them are doing great work, and all readers are the beneficiaries of it. But the simple fact is that the newspaper industry is in collapse and there is zero chance of that being reversed. The music industry, I'm talking about the industry, is in collapse and there's zero chance of that being reversed. Television, cable, and Hollywood are in extremis, and I see very little chance of any of them somehow finding magic beans to grow a business model in the middle of supply and demand glut. It's just a simple force of economic reality, supply and demand, that is irreversible in the digital age.
Mike Mesnick, I want to get you to respond, but maybe you could do you have a kind of business model or one in particular, or maybe there are various, I mean, you mentioned some, that are in fact going to be viable to sort of make the way forward?
Sure. And I think that it's important to recognize a few things. The first is that, you know, nothing will guarantee that anyone gets to make a living. And that's always been true. And especially in these businesses where it's always been very, very difficult. But I think and then the second point on that is that what's changed today is that there isn't just one business model for these things. If you wanted to be a reporter, you had to get a job at a newspaper. If you wanted to be a musician, you had to get signed to a record label. That's changed. And part of that is that each of those people now have many, many, many different ways that they might do it. So there isn't one business model. There is no magic bullet. And I think that's part of what's distressing for many people is that the lack of a roadmap, and it really is often, you know, stepping out into an empty room and not quite knowing where it's all going to go. And that's certainly a challenge, and that's very scary, I think, for those who are doing it. But that doesn't mean that there aren't business models or concepts that I think people are very, very successfully adopting already to in order to make money. And so, you know, one of the things that I discuss, which isn't so much a business model as a thought process for thinking through how to create a business model that appears to be working for many people, is to recognize that you need to figure out a way to connect with fans very, very closely, to build up an audience who trust you and respects you and wants to support you, and then give them a real reason to support you. You know, I sort of have this joking shorthand that it's as simple as connect with fans and give them a reason to buy. And of course, it's not that simple. It involves an awful lot of work and it's an amazing challenge. But the people who have successfully done that, who have built up a fan base who want to support them in any way possible, and then when you give them the opportunity to support you in a strong and compelling way, you tell them what it is that you're trying to accomplish and what it is you're trying to do, and you set up a system where they can get some return, something back for supporting you, those things seem to work. And we see that all the time, obviously, with crowdfunding and Kickstarter and Indiegogo and other things like that. There are a number of new companies that have stepped into this space as well. There's a new one called Patreon, which is a really cool concept that lets people support content creators every time they create something new automatically. We're seeing all sorts of really wonderful and new systems step in to make that much easier. And so I get a little worried when I hear people say that these industries are collapsing, and that there are no business models and that there's nothing that can be done, when everywhere I look, I see wonderful things happening and I see lots of people making money, making living, sometimes making very good livings, doing these things that under the old system, they would be, you know, maybe they'd be waiting tables because there wouldn't have been a way for them to do all of this.
Bob Garfield, you've written about this old model of advertising, which was at the time, you know, the perfect ecosystem. That's gone away as a model. So more direct contact with people who are creating, you know, music or content, how do you respond, I suppose? Is that the new model?
I respond by saying, in one sense, I absolutely agree. My latest book is about that very thing. It's about the cultivation of relationships on a one-by-one basis. And in the absence of the mass media and mass reach to be able to do just as Michael says. And I believe in that wholeheartedly. So when I describe the effects of digital revolution, you know, this is not a value judgment. I'm not saying that the good old days are better than the new digital reality. And, you know, there's something to be said for both the old media ecosystem and the new one.
Yeah.
However, the notion that all of these wonderful new ways of doing business are emerging and that we shouldn't dwell on the negative is simply silly. You take all of these new crowdsourcing methods and individual successes by individual artists cultivating individual followings, you add them all up and you multiply by about a drillion, and then you can recover the old economy. Never. They're all the king's horses and all the king's men in all of these industries have tried to find a way to replace the economic beauty of mass media and mass marketing in symbiosis, and they have failed, and they will always fail, because these are something like the physical laws of the universe. It's economic Isaac Newton. That's what the law of supply and demand is. And it is, once it cannot be defeated. You can do stuff at the margins, but the trillions of dollars that these industries were able to command, sustaining all sorts of commerce all across the world, they're just in a state of collapse. And again, it yields many more artists and many more writers and many more filmmakers doing very interesting work and getting to distribute it everywhere, but it is affecting the economy catastrophically.
Bob Garfield is with us, co-host of On the Media, which is heard Saturday afternoons at 2, Sunday mornings at 10 here on KUER. Mike Masnick with us, founder of the blog Tech Dirt and its parent company Floor 64. We'll take some of your calls when we get back from a break. 801-585-WEST, the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the costs of all of this free media of the internet era. We have with us Bob Garfield, co-host of On the Media, and Mike Masnick, founder of the blog Tech Dirt. We hope to hear from you. 801-585-WEST is the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's take a call. Don has been waiting in Colton, California. Don, welcome.
Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Sure.
My comment is about a medium that you guys haven't discussed yet, and that's books. I'm an author, and up until just recently, I was part of that free culture. I didn't see what was hurting anybody, but my novel got published about a year ago, and as you know, these days, unless you publish it yourself, it's very difficult to get a book published now, you know, with traditional publishers. Anyway, after my book got published, I'm racking up sales, things are going good, and then I see my novel on a file sharing site. And I was curious. I mean, I don't see where that's any different from walking into a bookstore, picking up my novel and sticking it in your back pocket and walking out the door. Every download is money out of my pocket. So I agree with your guest that it's no different. It's stealing. And of course, I want people to see my story. I love that. I love the reviews and all that. But it is my dream to make my living as a writer, and I can't do that when my book is being downloaded for free.
Don, glad you called. Thanks very much. Let me get a response. But Bob Garfield, do you want to respond? I mean, this is, again, we're not just talking about musicians or journalists. Authors, writers, they have something to say about this, too.
The book industry is, you know, I'm sorry that I left it off my list about media industries in collapse, but it was actually, along with music, it was among the first to suffer the onslaught of digital revolution. Dude, I feel your pain. I am a 5-time worst-selling author, and it's no fun for me to see my book in a file-sharing site. I will say this. You know, there is an argument, and some of the it's borne out by statistics in some cases, that the very process of being stolen from as a musician or as a writer actually can improve your net sales, because it takes your It takes your work to a larger audience. It becomes more of a topic of conversation, becomes a part of the buzz, and sends more people to actually to the cash register to buy. That has been demonstrated to work in some cases for music acts. And so, you know, your losses may not be as obvious as they seem. Nonetheless, it's hard for me to understand, and this gets back to what David Lowery was saying, how anybody justifies going to a file-sharing site and downloading your book for free. And it's I think that one's covered in the Ten Commandments, and it's, I don't see why it's controversial.
Mike Masnick, what about that particular question, the one that David Lowery raises? Don mentioned it, Bob, obviously, this question of ethics, this question of morality is how David Lowery puts it.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, morality is an interesting topic to discuss. I think that it's tricky to stand up and say, well, this is moral for everyone. I think, you know, morality is something that's very personal, and everyone has to make their own decisions in terms of, you know, what they're comfortable with. I think that the much more interesting question is, what do you do about it, right? You can stand up and say, this is immoral, this is awful, this is unethical, all you want. If everyone in the world disagrees with you, that's not going to do you very much good. And so, you know, what Bob was just saying, where there are examples of some people have seen benefit from it, you know, I would say that it's important to recognize that certainly does happen, but often the way it happens is because you have the content creator figuring out a way to step in and enhance their ability to turn that into a positive. So we've seen artists who have discovered that their works are on a file sharing site, and they've even, you know, commented on those, you know, on the pages where those works are available, and made the case like the caller just made, and said, hey, I'm a struggling author. I'm just trying to earn a living. If you like this, you know, I'm very happy to have my story out there for more people to hear my story, which is, you know, what he said, but, you know, I really need to make a living. And if you like this work and you really want to support it, here's how you can do it. And when we see people do things like that, it seems to have an impact. You know, when you start lecturing people on their morals and what their morality should be, it tends to turn people off, and it doesn't make that connection. Whereas if you work to build a connection and say, the people downloading this work, they probably like me and they like my work and they want me to be able to do more of it, let's focus on figuring out ways to improve that connection and to improve their ability to support me and to you know, build on this in a positive way, then the morality question begins to drop away, because you're focused on, let's build a relationship that works for everyone rather than lecturing other people about how they have to act.
Here's where Mike and I almost entirely agree. You know, David Lowery has been cursing the darkness for years now.
Yeah.
He doesn't like the way the internet culture has treated him and other artists, and he's been making a stink about it for some time, and righteously so. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't disagree with him on his facts or his analysis, but unfortunately, screaming at the darkness is not an availing strategy for creating light. And there is morality, however you define it, and then there is reality. And we are living in the digital world in which we live. And at some point, you have to just suck it up and say, this is human behavior. This is the legal regime as it exists in various countries. This is the marketplace in which we are dwelling, and we have to work within that. And at that point, you do have to find other solutions, because clearly being frustrated is not going to do the job. And the job of all media in this environment is to try to face reality and to adjust accordingly. Now, you know, I'm not saying that always works out well. I'm in the middle of a series of media post columns going after publishers for accepting so-called native advertising, which is what we used to call advertorial, and which is in essence advertising disguised as editorial matter. And this is the way publishers are adjusting, as I've just suggested, but it doesn't pass moral muster with me. So you know, I'm not sure which half of me you should believe, but the fact is there are tough decisions to be made, and sitting around feeling sorry for yourself doesn't really accomplish a whole lot.
Was there an opportunity, Bob, let me start with you on this one. Was there an opportunity early on in this revolution to establish some sort of more viable business model, you know, a paywall system? I mean, newspapers had an opportunity in some way, but they chose, we'll give it away for free at first.
Maybe. You know, I'm so ambivalent about this because, yeah. You know, culture is shared, right? And especially when we're talking about music and art in general. Art, of course, it does belong legally to the creator who has intellectual property protection and is able to monetize that for a specified period of time. But equally, the moment the artist lets go of it, it belongs to the culture. It belongs to the individual to interpret and process as he or she sees fit. And the digital world was made just for that. And I certainly believe that that one thing that the digital world has done is liberate us to get more value out of art and to put an end to the notion that the meaning and the significance and the ownership of the work ends with the auteur. On the other hand, there is, you know, there's still that thing called ownership, and the artists still have rights. And it's not always clear where the line should be drawn. So again, I cleave to reality. And so to answer your specific question, had newspapers put up paywalls, for example, instead of giving away content for free, thinking there was going to be a bonanza of online advertising revenue, again, forgetting the law of supply and demand, right. Had they done that, would we have been trained to think that you have to pay as you go? Maybe. But we're going to get trained eventually anyway, because a lot of the high quality content is just going to disappear. Content glut won't disappear, but the high production value content will, because it's being subsidized by traditional media who are borrowing from savings, by monks and amateurs, and by venture capitalists who will soon grow tired of investing in a monetization that's destined never to come. So I think eventually the culture will understand that it's got to put it's got to belly up to the bar with cash, or the stuff is just going to kind of vanish.
Mike Masnick, what do you think?
I think that that's there's some of that I agree with, and then some of it I'm not so sure about. You know, when you're talking about putting up a paywall around news or something like that, I think that what that really creates is actually a huge opportunity for others to step in and say, okay, if you're going to lock up all of the so-called high-quality content, that's a huge opportunity for me to step in and offer high-quality content for free with a better business model around it. And I recognize that, you know, that's not everyone is going to be able to succeed at that, and there are certainly challenges. But, you know, for sites that really, again, you know, I keep going back to it, but that have built up a really strong audience, we've seen that they can make money and that they can thrive and that they can get support for what they're trying to do in a variety of ways. And it's not just from getting direct payment from their readers. There are a lot of different ways that you can get payment, or there are a lot of different ways that readers and a community can pay a site that isn't always just about money or direct handover of cash from the consumer to the content producer. And, you know, when you take a step back and you look at what was the newspaper business really about in the past, it's always been about bringing together a community. You know, usually it was a community of local interest and sort of local goings on. And then what they were doing was they were selling the attention of that community, generally through advertising and a large part through the classifieds business. And when you put up a paywall, what you're really doing is almost locking off that community and limiting that community at a time when you have that glut of supply, as Bob was saying, and a lot of different places where people can go to join a community. And so when I see all these newspapers putting up paywalls, all I'm thinking is that they're actually limiting their ability to make money, because they're limiting the community that they can pull together. And yes, they're getting some direct money from them, but there's very little indication that that on its own is sustainable either. And you know,
and
I,
that's
I think
why
that...
we're in the world we live in. That's not sustainable, and the advertising model isn't sustainable, because if you open up your content and you try to use, let's say, an advertiser supported model, because you have many, many more readers, and you think, well, that's gonna yield riches. The problem is, again, supply and demand. You can fetch so little for advertising compared to what you could in the old days, that no matter how big your audience is, the cost per thousand, the rates that you get for the attention of the audience, is so vanishingly small that you can never make the nut. You can never meet costs, much less make a profit.
Well, that's not quite true. It's for if you're relying on advertising alone, especially if you're relying on banner advertising alone, that's absolutely true. I mean, there's the amount of money that's made from banner advertising is minuscule for most of these sites, vanishingly small. But if you're putting in place a variety of different models, and we're seeing, different journalism outlets that are using crowdfunding, that are using native advertising. I know that Bob has a problem with that, and I agree that when it's tricking readers into thinking that an advertorial is legitimate content, that's a problem. But I don't think that's what native advertising really is or should be about. I think that there's the ability to do native advertising in a way that you are supporting content that is actually valuable to the readers and to the community. When you see things like that done well, and when you see that mixed with a variety of other business models, it appears that there are things out there that do work and will continue to work. And I know that, going back a little bit to, Bob was talking about how much that the news business generated for the economy in the past. I think that you have to recognize that a significant part of that may have just been inefficiencies. I mean, you look at how big some of those organizations got and what they were spending their money on, and part of this might just be a correction towards more efficient production of news as well.
It's Mike Masnick, founder of the blog Tech Dirt, its parent company Floor 64. Mike, thanks very much for the time.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
And Bob Garfield, co-host of On the Media. You can hear it Saturday afternoons at 2, Sunday mornings at 10 here on KUER. And let me just mention, of course, his book, The Chaos Scenario. Bob, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure, Doug.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.